from Yellowstone National Park, this is Telemetry, stories of science and nature from the world's first national park. I'm Jennifer Jarrett. Today, we're turning up the heat, both on and under the landscape. Later in the program, we'll explore the Yellowstone supervolcano and the likelihood of a super eruption.
So a super eruption is a meaningful term, and that's when you have more than 1,000 cubic kilometers of material that comes out in a single event. So let's visualize that. If you took the state of Texas and you buried it 5 feet deep in material.
But up first, the story of the 2016 Maple Fire. This was the largest fire in Yellowstone since the historic fires of 1988.
Is there anything as wild, beautiful, and important as fire in Yellowstone? I'm not sure.
This is John Cataldo, the fire management officer for Yellowstone National Park, which means it's his job to manage everything having to do with fire in the park.
It seems like we're always at work in the summer, and somehow, at least my impression is that 80% of the fires we get are when I'm at home eating dinner. So fires and telemarketers are who finds me at 7 o'clock at night at my home.
And on the night of August 8th, 2016, John got that kind of call. An aircraft full of smoke jumpers flying over Yellowstone National Park spotted a new fire. The jumper aircraft circled the fire, collected a GPS location, and then they texted John's crew.
Yeah, sent us a photo. I mean, that's the information age, right? So we had a report. We had a photo from the aircraft of the fire, gave us a basic idea of the fuels that were in the immediate vicinity of it. It was about a quarter acre. And that's, generally speaking, what I have to work with in a remote environment, for starters.
The fire was located on the far western side of the park, just about 6 miles east of the town of West Yellowstone. So John did what he often does. He notified the deputy superintendent and the chief ranger, and then he called Yellowstone's fire ecologist to run the nearest weather station for wind data. Very early the next morning, John pored over maps of the area and all the collected data on the new fire, and then he had this really big decision to make. To put the fire out or to let it burn.
Essentially, it comes down to, do we think this is a good fire or a bad fire?
And with this fire, the Maple Fire, being so close to the town of West Yellowstone was a huge consideration.
A lot goes into it, but at the end of the day, it's a real estate game, and it's location, location, location.
But the fire had two things going for it being a good fire. First, 95% of the winds in recorded history at the closest weather station had blown from the west or southwest, directions that would push the flames farther away from the community of West Yellowstone and deeper into the park backcountry. So while winds were likely to push the fire in the other direction, John knew that the proximity to West Yellowstone would have a lot of people interested in this fire.
Well, you want to provide insurance. So 95% is a pretty high number, right? If I give you 95% odds on a blackjack hand, you'd probably push your house payment out there. But 5% is a pretty substantial risk if you're the one living in the community on the 5% end of that.
But the second thing that helped managers feel like the Maple Fire might be a good fire? It was that the fire had started in an area that had burned way back in the 1988 fire season.
You know, if you were to play word association with anyone in West Yellowstone since 1988, and you say 88, the first thing they're going to say is fire. There's no other word.
1988 was a particularly dry summer in Yellowstone. When lightning storms hit the park in August, large fires sprouted everywhere, fires so big that tens of thousands of firefighters were mobilized to fight them. National news covered the events nightly.
In recorded history, we had not been that dry.
That's Roy Rankin, Yellowstone's vegetation management specialist, who has been looking at fire's effects in the park for almost 40 years. Roy saw the 1988 fires firsthand.
And as a consequence, these fires were large with these big flaming fronts, and they were moving with dramatic spread rates. You could measure them in multiple kilometers per hour. And you'd fly along at the head of some of these fires, and you would think that, you know, the fire is moving faster than the aircraft is. So it was pretty dramatic stuff.
And back in 1988, there was a lot of pressure to put these fires out. For 100 years, the majority of land managers had been putting out almost every wildfire they could immediately. And it was part of greater American culture to automatically think of forest fires as a threat. And because fires hadn't burned through most of Yellowstone for hundreds of years, the forests were thick with fuels to burn. A whole lot of fuel in a really dry year. The fires got big enough that their smoke blew all of the way from Wyoming to Chicago. Media scrutiny was intense. So much so that President Ronald Reagan weighed in, sending in the military to fight the fires.
It was a quarter of an inch of snow on September 11th of 1988 that did what, 10,000 firefighters, 220 different aircraft, so many miles of fire line, couldn't do. And it put a halt to the 88 fires, a quarter of an inch of snow. What people didn't realize is that these fires, just like the sun comes up in the day and the moon comes up at night, western forests burn.
By the end of the 88 fire season, nearly 800,000 acres in Yellowstone had burned, one-third of the entire park. That much area burning in a protected ecosystem created a unique place to study the effects of big fires on a landscape. Scientists noted a series of benefits to that ecosystem after the 88 fires, demonstrating a value to letting naturally caused fires burn. Chief amongst them, the pattern of areas burned in different years created a mosaic of forest ages with a diversity of plants present. And this diversity of plant habitats was really good for most animals. Also, since there was less fuel where previous fires burned through, the mosaic of past fires helped provide a really great boundary to stop new forest fires from becoming large. Which brings us back to the Maple Fire starting in 2016 and the decision that John Cataldo had to make, to let the Maple Fire burn or to put it out.
Well, fire is the lifeblood of the Yellowstone ecosystem. So if we exclude fire, essentially this ecosystem as we know it dies. It would grow decadent and expire. So fire here is essentially the ecological reset button. And our job is to keep as much of it on the landscape as we can safely do. But it's complicated. Yeah, we're just facilitating the conversation between fire and humans, essentially. This park will never have a fire problem. Essentially what it has is 2,000 structures and 4 million visitors that we need to work our tails off during fire season to keep separated from the fire that we need on the landscape. And that's the challenge. It's 2,000 structures and 4 million visitors.
And so here was this new fire, the Maple Fire, started by a lightning strike in the middle of a big area that had burned in 1988. And since 1988, due to that mosaic of forest ages, fires starting in the 88 burn area, they hadn't really gone anywhere. And so John and his team decided to let the fire burn, thinking it would just kind of sputter out.
Eyes were wide open as that fire persisted and became 2 acres and then 5, and then maybe a week or so into the fire being on the landscape, it was in the hundreds. And we knew that we were going to have a substantial fire until the snow flew.
And for everyone who studies fire in Yellowstone, this fact, a fire growing large in the 88 burn scar, was something odd.
Generally speaking, up to that point, the 88 fire scar in a lot of ways was almost viewed as asbestos. It was a great natural barrier to fire spread. So for a lot of our fires since 88, we're using that fire scar as a boundary.
But not anymore. A tall column of smoke formed as the fire grew, a huge plume that could be seen from far away. Just 6 miles away, in West Yellowstone, residents started to get nervous about their proximity to the growing fire.
Yeah, things were tense in West Yellowstone, particularly in the beginning of the life of the Maple Fire. And, you know, I joke about it now, but, you know, some of those first public meetings were 200 pitchforks and tiki torches out there in the crowd.
A dozen fire public information officers were brought in to organize daily public meetings to make sure that the most current information and management plan was getting out. In total, over 400 firefighters were assigned to manage the blaze.
To be honest, the strategy that was eventually employed by the incident management team was something we'd sketched out on a cocktail napkin on about the third day of that fire burning.
The main plan was to control the fire's edge near West Yellowstone and let the rest of the fire keep burning slowly, like lava, eastward. To do so, firefighters would allow the fire to chew its way toward the Madison River on the west side. Then, using the river as a boundary, they'd employ a tactic called a backfire, starting a new fire on the edge of the river. And as the Maple Fire sucked in air to feed its flames, it would pull the firefighter-ignited burn eastward. The two fires would then join, leaving no more fuel on the western flank for the Maple Fire to carry into. And it worked. But managers were still surprised that the fire was burning heavily in the 88 burn scar at all.
We suspect it was the extreme dryness of the large logs that were dead and downed and underneath. So for a lot of the Maple Fire area, the fire wasn't carrying through the tops of the vegetation. It was actually first burning underneath through the heavy woody debris, and it would scorch and dry out things enough above it that they would eventually, you know, become consumed after the main fire had passed.
And other than burning in the 88, the Maple Fire did what many people thought it would do. For the most part, it kept slowly burning east while firefighters watched over it. And eventually, much like the 88 fire season, snow and rain in September put the Maple Fire out. All of which is what fire managers had planned for.
And now the community of West Yellowstone has a 45,000-acre fire scar on one side of it that is going to insulate it from any fires that we may want to control and can't that originate in that part of the park.
And both John and Roy say that warmer overall temperatures associated with climate change are likely to complicate fire on the landscape. With predictions of fire becoming more likely in the park, the overall makeup of forests may change. Some tree species, such as lodgepole pine, are expected to decline, while others, like Douglas fir, become more prevalent. And the changing environment in Yellowstone poses new challenges that have fire managers like John looking towards the future.
From where I'm sitting, right, because I'm one of the ones making the decision whether a fire should be encouraged to be on the landscape or suppressed, I just keep defaulting to fire is what this ecosystem needs. And ultimately, if climate change dictates that the ecosystem looks differently or functions differently, it's going to be with fire in it. We're not going to start going backwards and putting out fires out of fear of climate change.
And John says that seeing the big picture is the main reason not to go backwards.
Like the expression goes, you trust the process. And what we're doing is managing processes. We're not managing species. We're not even just managing plant communities. We're managing entire processes that we don't completely, and nor will ever completely understand all the interrelationships of what fire brings to that. So, trusting the process.
For Yellowstone National Park, I'm Scott Christie.
You're listening to Telemetry, stories of science and nature from the world's first national park. I'm Jennifer Jarrett. People travel from all over the world to see Yellowstone's geysers, hot springs, fumaroles, and mud pots. One of the forces that drives these amazing thermal features is a giant volcano, and it lies below much of the park. In this story, we're talking about Yellowstone's volcanic past, present, and future.
Imagine that you're standing on a boardwalk in Yellowstone National Park. It's a sunny day in the height of summer. People around you look at their watches, and then they back up, waiting for something to happen. And right then, this starts. A stream of water shoots 4 or 5 feet out of a hole in the ground. It pulses up and down a few times and then jets over 100 feet into the air. And it continues to do this for a few minutes. This would be Old Faithful erupting next to you, the most famous of Yellowstone's features. It does that all the time, with similar blasts coming from the ground at least every 2 hours.
I don't know, I get caught up just like anyone else. You know, when I am visiting Old Faithful, I stop and I watch the eruptions.
That's Mike Poland, the scientist in charge at the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory.
Doesn't matter how many times you see it, it's no less spectacular to me than the first time I saw it. And the more you know about what's driving this, I think the more spectacular it becomes, that it's this heat engine that's beneath our feet that's made this possible. You're seeing the upper expression of this heat engine right at the surface. And I think it's sort of a magical sort of thought to have as you're watching these geysers go off.
Well, there are geysers all over the world. Mike says that Yellowstone is famous for holding the greatest concentration of geysers anywhere, and that these geysers have a deeper source.
Well, in order to get a geyser to really go, you need heat. You need water and heat. And, of course, we have plenty of water around here. And the heat is supplied by a magma body that's underneath Yellowstone.
Which is basically a bunch of molten rock from the Earth's mantle rising up into the Earth's crust.
The magma body is sometimes referred to as a supervolcano, or the Yellowstone system is called a supervolcano. It gets that name because it can be the source of some truly humongous eruptions.
Yeah, this is kind of a funny jargon sorts of stuff.
That's Jake Lowenstern. He was Mike's predecessor as the head of the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. Jake says that what defines a volcano as a supervolcano is a past super eruption, and that such eruptions are really, really big.
So a super eruption is a meaningful term, and that's when you have more than 1,000 cubic kilometers of material that comes out in a single event. So that's let's try and visualize that. 1,000 cubic kilometers, if you took the state of Texas and you buried it 5 feet deep in material.
These super eruptions are much bigger than the largest volcanic eruptions of the 20th century, like Mount St. Helens or Pinatubo. The closest we've come to one in modern history was in 1815, when an eruption of Mount Tambora in Indonesia threw so much ash into the atmosphere that it was known as the Year Without a Summer. The eruption and following climate change caused crops to fail in Europe and New England, and even prompted Lord Byron to write a poem about that summer titled Darkness. And Tambora's 1815 eruption? It is dwarfed in size by Yellowstone's prehistoric super eruptions, at least 10 times smaller. There are a number of volcanoes other than Yellowstone that have produced super eruptions in the past. But Jake says that in the Earth's history, these big super eruptions are pretty rare, with one going off every 100,000 years or so on average. And much like Yellowstone, these other super volcanoes are not usually the cone-shaped mountains we often associate with volcanoes. Not that big triangle you might have drawn in grade school. Instead, these super volcanoes are essentially giant sinkholes surrounded by mountains.
And these sinkholes, or calderas, are what's left after devastatingly large super eruptions take place, blowing up everything that used to be there. Just like with Yellowstone's caldera, a caldera about the size of Rhode Island.
It's had three very, very large volcanic eruptions. The most recent one was 640,000 years old. So that seems incredibly old, and it is, but that was one of the largest eruptions in the last 20 million years in the United States. And it's one of the big eruptions on Earth that's well recorded in the geologic record. And Yellowstone is capable of doing that. So you have a lot of different things that happen here, yet because everybody has in their mind this one kind of big bad eruption, everybody assumes that if there is an eruption, it has to be the worst case scenario, and that everybody's doomed, and that's just wrong.
According to Jake, the kind of eruption most likely at Yellowstone would have a more regional impact. A small-scale eruption that could come in a few forms. Say, a giant belch of superheated gas and water from Yellowstone's underground plumbing system, or oozing lava flows like the ones in Hawaii.
It'll affect the people in the park, and it'll affect the park if something like that happens. There'll be forest fires, and when you bring lava out on the ground, it's hot. There's going to be road closures. You might dam up some rivers. But it's not going to be a national event. And that's the most likely kind of thing that can happen. And even that is not very likely. One hasn't happened for 70,000 years.
You can still see the evidence of prehistoric lava flows throughout the park. Flows that formed the main plateaus of rock across Yellowstone. But again, Jake really isn't too worried about new lava flows or other big volcano events popping up anytime soon.
If I were offered a job here and I were at the right time of life, I would certainly live here in a second.
Learning more about the Yellowstone volcano's past and paying attention to its present is what scientists like Mike and Jake do as members of the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. Scientists at the observatory come from groups like the United States Geological Survey, the National Park Service, and universities of the states surrounding the park. Again, Mike Poland.
Some of us are geophysicists. Some of us are geochemists. Some of us specialize in gas emissions or rock compositions. Other people specialize in locating earthquakes. So it's a unique group of scientists, and it's all really getting at ways of understanding, better understanding, the current activity and the processes that are happening now beneath our feet.
Research trying to understand the volcano can lead scientists in unexpected directions. Mike and fellow researcher Elske de Zeeuw van Dolfsen are standing in the middle of a lodgepole pine forest as heavy wind whips the trees back and forth.
My goodness. I mean, I know they're designed to do this, but it's a little unnerving.
As Mike and Elske deploy a sensitive piece of equipment to measure gravity at the site, a pine tree maybe 30 feet tall breaks and falls to the ground, while the rest of the trees continue to crack and whine.
That would be an interesting manifestation in the gravity record if we had it running when that tree fell. We'd detect the vibrations from that. Okay, so we're doing a gravity survey throughout the park right now. And the idea is that gravity actually isn't a constant. It varies depending on what's beneath your feet. It will especially vary over time if there's an influx in mass beneath the ground, say water or magma. If there's more water or magma beneath the ground, gravity actually pulls a little stronger. And we can record that with these instruments.
These measurements of gravity could provide a better understanding of changes in the magma chamber below the park, and are one example of ongoing research at the observatory. Scientists are also studying the age of gases released by geysers and fumaroles to understand how old the molten rocks below the surface are and where in the Earth's crust they are being melted from. Other researchers are measuring recent ground deformation, which means the changing shape of the Earth's surface caused from below. In 2014, in the park near Norris,
the ground began to uplift by several centimeters a year, which is extraordinary by geologic standards. This is something that, of course, you wouldn't notice, but measuring it with GPS and with radar satellites, we can see this uplift. Then there was an earthquake, and right after this magnitude 4 or so earthquake, the ground started to subside by about the same rate, several centimeters a year.
Researchers think that earthquake was caused by pressure releasing, heated water accumulating behind a seal and the seal breaking. After that, the ground started falling as the water drained out from behind the barrier. And while all this research helps scientists better understand what's going on under the park, Yellowstone's past of large eruptions can add a dramatic flair to current events surrounding the volcano. In 2017, thousands of earthquakes were detected occurring in just over 3 months near West Yellowstone. Major news outlets often covered the story of the earthquake swarms and were quick to cite the potential for disaster.
It seems that whenever there's an earthquake swarm at Yellowstone, this idea that the volcano is about to erupt comes up. And there are swarms all the time. If it were true that Yellowstone swarms were indicating an eruption was imminent, then eruption is likely to be imminent every year. So this is just the way Yellowstone works. Yellowstone releases seismic energy in swarms. Some swarms are big, some swarms are small. It's what Yellowstone does. So they're not anything to get worried about. In my opinion, they're more something to get interested by. The rocks that are around tell a heck of a story. Obsidians and ash flows and basalt lava flows all mingled together. So there's a story recorded in the rocks which tells the geologic history of Yellowstone, and it's an interesting story.
And this story, the story of the volcano, it can be seen everywhere in Yellowstone. It's one of the things that makes Yellowstone so unique. The shape of the land, the course of the rivers, and all of the amazing thermal features, they're all dictated by the volcano. Even plant and animal habitats in the park are defined by volcanic rock types. The volcano isn't just written across the landscape, it is the landscape. And this is something special to see, even for a scientist studying it.
It's a place, there's a reason that there are millions of people a year that come to visit. It's really a privilege to work in such a spectacular place, not just geologically and volcanologically, but also in terms of its ecology, in terms of its landscapes. It's a real wonderland. So come to Yellowstone and look at the landscape and explore the geology.
For Yellowstone National Park, I'm Scott Christie.
Telemetry is a production of Yellowstone National Park. You can check out more stories at go.nps.gov/telemetry. Our major supporter is Yellowstone Forever, the official nonprofit partner of Yellowstone National Park. More at yellowstone.org. Additional support comes from Canon USA's Eyes on Yellowstone program. Thanks also to the Acoustic Atlas at the Montana State University Library. This is Telemetry. Thanks for listening.